live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
Let's talk about it. Are you talking about it? Are you more or less inhibited about talking about sex than you were when you were younger? Or your sexual health with your doctor or your partner? Were you more open about it when you were just starting out on your journey? Or has age made you much more likely to go there? Hello, and I'm Mary Guerin. Welcome to The Conversation Hour. This is going to be a bit of a journey this hour into the wild and wonderful world of our human bodies. You might have seen reporting in the ABC today about falling condom use among young people, but it seems older is not necessarily wiser when it comes to sex. One study, it's a few years back now, but it did indicate that sexually transmissible infections, STIs, increased in women between 55 and 74. Why is that? The fact is, we don't know enough about older adults' sexual health because it's just not researched. And so why is that? We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about sex. As Abba said, we're not too old for sex. Of course, if we choose to do that, tell me if you're finding it easier or harder to talk about sex and sexual health than in other stages of your life, wherever you are on your journey. Also today, when sex leads to family life, did you have baby brain or did you think you had baby brain? Certainly when I was pregnant, I felt I was all over the shop, forgot why I walked into a room. Well, it turns out science says baby brain is not a thing. Do you believe that? Medical experts in Melbourne have looked into it and say, nope, that's, dare I say it, all in our heads. There's no objective evidence that there is a decline in cognition when pregnant or when you're a young mum or dad. But let's have our own unscientific poll today. Was baby brain, maybe I just can't still have it, can I? Baby brain real for you? Maybe you are pregnant or a young parent. You'd like to tell me, is it real for you right now? What do you remember, if you can remember, of your baby brain? Tell me your stories. Was it real enough for you, no matter what the researchers say? Tell me, are you more or less inhibited about talking about sex or your sexual health? Next, we'll talk about why it's so important.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So, joining me now is Dr. Sue Malta, who's a sexual health and ageing researcher with the School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne University. Thanks for joining us, Sue.
Hello, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
We're talking about sex, and I want people to call me 1300 222 774, whether you are feeling more inhibited or less inhibited talking about sex and sexual health, whether it's with your doctor or your partner or your friends. Tell me about it, 1300 222 774. So I'm talking to you because talking about sexual health is important because we suspect that there is a worrying rate of STIs among older Australians. Tell us about it.
So we've looked at the rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea and infectious syphilis. We did it in the years 2000-2018. Well, our PhD student Louise Boucher did, to be specific, and we found a trend of them going up, but because not a lot of older adults get tested or their doctors don't recognise that they're presenting with the STIs, the numbers don't really, we think, don't reflect what's really happening.
Okay.
So we have no idea what the numbers are specifically.
So the lack of research, the lack of follow-up is a problem in itself?
Well, yes, because we do know that more and more older adults are becoming sexually active.
Do we?
Yes, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that. We've got increasing rates of divorce amongst older people. We've got widowhood, and we've got the internet now, and apps, and more older people use apps and go on websites to find new partners. Mm. And and with new partners comes new sexual activity. And we also know that a lot of older people don't use barrier protection, condoms and the like, because why would they? They don't think they're not going to get pregnant.
But of course, when you're a teenager, yes, that's the main message. That's the main fear that's put into teenagers' brains. And you're saying that as we age, we just don't make the connection anymore between condoms and preventing STIs?
Well, I think it's a bit more complex than that, because for some older people, they've been in a long-term monogamous relationship, say, you know, and I'm not talking about everybody, clearly. Mm. Yeah. I can't make an assumption that everybody was in a monogamous relationship or in a long-term relationship, but it's likely that a lot of older people were, and they've not had to use condom protection or other barrier protection for a long time.
Yeah.
So it might not necessarily enter into their head. And the fact is, when you're finding new partners, you might have more than one.
Mm.
And your partner might have more than one. So you don't necessarily know how many people you're both going to bed with. So,
And you're not too old to learn that lesson. Listening to Dr. Sue Malter, who's from Melbourne University. We're talking about whether or not we're more or less inhibited about talking about sex or sexual health as we get older. Liz, you've called in from Doncaster. What did you want to say?
Oh, yes. Look, I'm an older person, but I used to listen to Dee Selman's sex program on Triple J.
I am,
and I can tell you it was pretty out there, but I thought it was very interesting and guiding people to what's acceptable and what's not, particularly for young people. I was thinking more about my young 20-year-old children, and then she's written. In April, I think she launched her book, It's Not Love, actually. And I'm telling you, it's such a good book on relationships with sex as a major subject.
Oh, never too late to learn then, Liz, yeah?
Look, it's not. But it was more I was interested in sex education, what's happening.
Yeah.
And this book, and I've not heard this book mentioned on Radio National or the ABC at all. And I'm telling you, I can recommend it to young people and to parents who are concerned about sex education.
So that's Dee Selman is the author. And what's the name of it, Liz?
It's called It's Not Love, Actually.
It's Not Love, Actually. Liz, thank you. That's a really good tip. Dr. Sue Malter is with us. She's been listening to Liz. That's the sort of thing that we can just engage in at all points, just sort of get up to speed at any age, right, Sue?
Yes. And Louise has been looking at this sexual health information needs of older adults, and predominantly they go online to look for sexual health information. But the problem with that is that a lot of it's not tailored for older adults. Mm. You know, there are certain websites out there that are really good. The Jean Hales Institute, for instance, has some great stuff for older women. And I think it's what was formerly Prostate Cancer Australia. Sorry, I haven't got the name correctly. Mm. It slipped my mind. But I think it was Androgyny Australia or something like that. That's got some great resources for men, but they're not necessarily easy to find, and they're not, a lot of things aren't targeted specifically for older adults.
Mm.
Yeah. And the thing to note is that sometimes people don't know what questions to ask.
That's right. Sue Malter is with me. She's from Melbourne University. We're talking about the importance of talking about sex and sexual health. And the flip side to all this, Sue, isn't it, that we are sexual beings? That's a good thing. That it can be good for us. It has lots of beneficial effects.
Yes, so it's great for our positive health, physical health and mental health. So it's great for our general well-being. It lowers blood pressure. It can do all sorts of wonderful things for our physical and mental well-being. So it's not something that people necessarily should think, oh, I'm past that. But you don't have to have a partner to be sexually active.
This is true.
There's also that to reinforce,
right.
You know, and for a lot of older people, it's about reimagining themselves and refinding themselves as a sexual person in their later life.
Mm. Can I just put this to you from the text line, Sue? This texter says, I can say from experience older men will not use condoms. Is this part of the research that is not yet done, in your view? Do you know whether that rings true?
Well, I don't know whether that rings true. Mm. This person has said that from their experience. Well, then you would just say, well, if it's not on, it's not on, correct? Mm. Isn't that one of those slogans that they used to say for younger people?
That's right.
But there is some research that shows that older women are less likely to insist on a condom being worn by a new partner. So I think there needs to be more education. But there's also, you need to be able to talk to your doctor about your sexual health needs. Mm. And I think there's a limit there. It's typically been a taboo subject because we have this ageist attitude, these perceptions about older adults as not being sexually active, and some people aren't, and that's okay too.
And that's okay too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's a big spectrum, and you.
But just be wise, people.
Don't do it.
Yeah, that's right. Just remember the lessons that you learned.
Part of our research is that, and other researchers found this too, that you can go to the doctor, but older adults don't know how to broach the subject. Always, some do. Some have quite forthright about this, but other people aren't. And the doctor doesn't necessarily bring it up either because there's a lack of time. They don't know what to say.
Yeah.
They have their own ageist perceptions. One of the doctors we talked to in one of our previous studies said, well, it's like talking to my mum and dad about sex. I can't.
So there needs to be an attitude change on both sides of that desk. Sue, thank you so much for shedding a light on, you know, the lack of research that there is, but the issues at play. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Dr. Sue Malter, who is sexual health and ageing researcher with the School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne University. We have heard there talking about older women and very soon we're going to be, I can see on the text line that there's question marks about menopause as well, how that can affect our sexual lives. We will talk about that and the recently announced campaign around menopause. This on text, and about a few friends have started meeting new people online in their 50s and both have contracted STIs. We need to learn those lessons that Sue was talking about. Also, this on text, hoping Mary plays some Barry White before we get to that talk about menopause and so forth. Let's go there.
Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change. Something moving. I scream your name. That's what you got to do with darling.
Oh, yes. I hope that put everyone in whatever mood you want to be in. We are talking today on the Conversation Hour about lots of things. Soon we'll be talking about when sex leads to babies. Do babies lead to baby brain? Science says no, but what do you think? 1300 222 774 is the number to call me to join that conversation. But yes, we've been talking about all things when it comes to our sexual health. And Jean Hales, as you know, are experts on menopause, but they've looked at this very thing as well. Joining me now is Dr. Sarah White, who's CEO of Jean Hales. Thanks for joining me, Sarah. What have you found?
You're very welcome.
What have you found when it comes to that either lack of knowledge or, I don't know, forgetting the knowledge about contraception in older life?
Well, this is something that came up actually from the Jean Hales clinics a couple of years ago. One of the sexual health physicians grabbed me and said, hey, listen, we're starting to see this real increase in STIs in midlife and older women that we haven't sort of seen before. So we've been aware of it. And I think, you know, all we can guess, and Professor Malter is really the expert in this space, is women simply being unaware that or not thinking of the need to use barrier protection when they start entering these new relationships.
Mm. We've got quite a few texts about the effect of menopause as well when it comes to using condoms. What would you say about that? This on text, menopause also means vaginal skin is much, is much more sensitive. I'm single and 50 and I'm finding condoms really hard to tolerate.
Yeah, look, that's a very common thing. So your vaginal tissues do get thinner and drier. Condoms can be a really good opportunity to play around with some lubricant as well. And for anyone who's really struggling, you really should go and talk to your doctor about vaginal estrogen as well, because that's just a topical cream that can really help with those issues around menopause.
And so I guess also you would be saying that, you know, looking at different ways of having a sexual life is part of that answer as well?
Absolutely. Sex doesn't have to be penetrative. You can still have quite a bit of fun without doing that as well, the sexual health physicians tell me. So, you know, there are plenty of other options. It doesn't have to be about penetration.
It is coming up to 22 minutes past 11. We are talking about sex and talking about sex. 1300 222 774. Are you finding it easier or more difficult to talk about sex and sexual health? Is there a problem talking to your doctor about it as you get older? Or are you finding it easier? I'd love to hear your stories. Also, there's when we think about menopause and the link to loss of libido, that's a bit of a complicated question, isn't it?
It sure is. One of the things that is clear, though, that it's not necessarily that loss of libido is not necessarily about a woman's age. It can actually be more about the age of the relationship. So there's two types of desire, that spontaneous desire where it's, you know, very common at the start of a relationship, that out of the nowhere feeling of wanting sex. And that's quite different from responsive desire, which is building more on intimacy, and that interest in sex comes from building on the intimacy. So if you're a 65-year-old woman in a brand new relationship, you might have a lot more of the spontaneous desire. Whereas if you're a 40-year-old woman in a long-term relationship, perhaps the responsive desire is more at play there. So it's important to sort of try and be a little bit more, well, not worry as much if that spontaneous desire isn't there. That's kind of natural as relationships age. The job, I guess, of any partnership is to try and recapture some of that playfulness and really lean into the benefits and the really lovely parts of having that responsive desire instead.
You're listening to Dr. Sarah White from Jean Hales. We are talking about sexual health and how we talk about sex over the years. Does it get harder or easier? On 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Jean Hales, of course, are the menopause experts, and there's been big news in the menopause world, as it were, in Australia recently. There's a national campaign that's been announced. It's going to happen. What can a campaign offer that we don't already have?
Well, I think the campaign is going to be really helpful in terms of helping women identify those menopausal symptoms as they start. So when you've been through menopause, you've been around menopausal age women, it's we have an understanding of what menopause is. But for younger women sort of coming up behind us, Mary, a lot of them feel worried about menopause. They're worried they won't recognise the symptoms. When symptoms start to happen, they don't quite link them to menopause. So this sort of campaign is going to be really helpful in identifying those symptoms. Really importantly, reassuring women are not alone, and I think trying to take some of that fear and uncertainty out of it.
So is it's aimed, do you think, or should it be aimed at younger women in particular?
Well, there are two components to the campaign, which was launched on Monday, so we should be seeing it in the wild, if you like, on television soon or on social media. The two components, there's really one that's around those menopause symptoms, but one that's around aimed at younger women to start telling them a little bit more about perimenopause, which is sort of the period leading up to menopause, the final menstrual period. So we're going to, it is being targeted at younger women so that as soon as they start to have some of these really common symptoms that are associated with the menopause transition, they can sort of say, oh, that's what that is. Now I know how to address it. And there's a lot of information sitting on a campaign website that people can be directed to.
And you're worried about the misinformation and disinformation as well that some of these particularly younger women are getting?
Really worried about the misinformation in the menopause space. There is a thing called menowashing. I think you and I have discussed it before, where people are really using menopause as the excuse to sell things from, you know, supplements to teas to chocolates to you name it. There's a menopause product out there. And unfortunately, what a lot of this marketing does is stoke fear about menopause. So these marketers want women to be worried about menopause, so they'll buy their, you know, menopause tea or menopause supplement, and that's doing a real disservice to women. So this campaign, I think, is a really great counter to that.
Sarah, if this campaign works, what would the situation be like in Australia, do you think, in, say, 5 years' time? What would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see menopause completely normalised in discussions. So we would have it being discussed very openly in families, in workplaces, having it really be acknowledged as just a natural, normal part of a woman's life. Women will have symptoms. They'll go straight to a doctor who can support them with the right treatment. Because this campaign is just one part of a bigger effort. And I have to give credit to the Albanese government on this. They're investing in education for GPs as well. So I think this is part of a whole package that's really going to make a difference.
Dr. Sarah White, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Sarah White is CEO of Jean Hales. We're talking there about menopause, but before that, the effect of menopause on libido. We're talking about sex and attitudes towards talking about sex as we age. And this is about the worrying rate of STIs that we have. This on text, I think it's due to men between 55 and 75 cheating on their female partners. Adults are pretty naive, says another texter, if they have sex and don't consider the possibility of getting STDs, as I think that's now called STIs, I'm not sure. And yes, how do you recapture your partner's desire after she reaches menopause and loses libido? That's from Graham. And this on text, at age 62, by the time I get a condom on, the opportunity is past. Name withheld to protect the innocent. Tell me about your stories. We will get to that. Sheena in Cobram, what would you want to say? Hello.
You're talking about educating women on the science of menopause. I think the campaign's not pointing in the right direction. It needs to be pointed at the doctors, because I've been to my doctor with signs of menopause and he said, you're too young for that.
Oh, goodness. Did you find another doctor, Sheena? What's your response to that?
I'm working on finding another doctor, but I have complex needs in other areas, so I don't want to totally ditch one doctor who works for something, but I'm going to have to find another doctor just for my menopause and women's health.
Yeah, Sheena, if there's one thing we've learned, isn't it, that don't take no for an absolute answer in this area. Thank you. I think there'd be a lot of people who would share that experience, so thank you for calling. This is the Conversation Hour. We are talking about those stories, about talking about sex. Also this hour, if you've ever found that the anxiety waiting for the results of a scan almost feels worse than the condition that you're scanning about. We will talk about that. How you live from scan to scan, blood test to blood test. That might be you. But next, science says baby brain is not a thing. Do you believe that? Tell me if it is a thing for you or it has been real for you or was. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. It's the Conversation Hour. Let's have a little bit more of that Barry White.
The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
It is the Conversation Hour. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Science says there's no such thing as baby brain, which is that cognitive decline that so many of us have talked about for years and years. Apparently it's not a thing, it's all in our head, so to speak. Joining me now is Dr. Kelsey Pericard, who's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative, which I can never say. Sorry about that, Kelsey. Studies. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I want to put to you very first up a text that I got saying, obviously men did the study on whether there's a baby brain, lol. But apparently you helped do that study, is that right?
I did help do that study, yes. There are women on the team.
Right. So tell us about it. What did you go in essentially expecting to prove baby brain?
We really expected to measure a cognitive decline in the postpartum period. We looked at both men and women, mums and dads, and were looking for whether or not there was cognitive decline in the first 2 years postpartum.
And what did you find?
We found no evidence for differences between parents and non-parents or between mums and dads, which was really surprising to us. There was no cognitive decline measurable in the postpartum period across a range of cognitive measures.
So what were the cognitive measures? What were you measuring?
We measured multiple aspects of memory, so that included subjective and objective memory. We measured simple reaction time, so how fast can you respond to something that appears on a screen. We measured executive functions, including response inhibition and task switching. And across all of these measures, we found evidence for no differences between any of our groups. So that was parents and non-parents, mums and dads.
You're listening to Kelsey Pericard from Monash University. Do you agree with science? 1300 222 774. Is this right? Or will you, in your unscientific way, say, nope, I definitely had it. I felt it. It went away. 1300 222 774. Or maybe it didn't go away. Or text 0437 774 774. So, Kelsey, I was fascinated by your findings because, in fact, something does happen to a woman's brain in pregnancy. What you're saying is it doesn't affect the cognitive function. But when we have heard about brains changing in pregnancy, tell us about that and the, yes, the delineation around that.
Yeah, so the brain does change in pregnancy. There's consistent evidence now that there's a reduction in gray matter volume. So that's the parts of the brain that do the thinking during pregnancy, and that persists into postpartum period. And there is some evidence that actually baby brain in the third trimester is objectively measurable. It's just in this postpartum period that we're finding these surprising results that there's no differences between parents and non-parents on cognitive measures.
Right. So it's different between being pregnant and afterwards, whether you're a new mum or dad.
That's right. And it's also important to note that those reductions in gray matter volume are not necessarily a bad thing. The brain does a lot of changing and pruning. So you can think of like a tree where you cut off the branches to make it more efficient in the way that it processes information in this case, or how the tree grows in the case of a tree. So not all reductions in gray matter volume are bad.
You're listening to Kelsey Pericard, who is from the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. Is baby brain real? You tell me. 1300 222 774. Science says no, apparently. Got a lot of this on text, Kelsey. Surely baby brain is partly due to being sleep deprived with a young baby. That's very real. This on as well. Pretty sure that tiredness affects one's brain. New mums get very little sleep, and dads as well, I would add to that. Is that part of it, do you think, Kelsey?
That is definitely part of it. So this research also shows that sleep has a big effect on how good people thought their memory was across the whole sample. So that was about perceptions of memory. So if you have more sleep, you perceive your memory as being better than it actually is, or better than people who don't get sleep. But this is not particular to the parent group. So across the whole sample, people who sleep more feel better about their memory.
Mm. You've noted this is science speaking. This is about objective measurement. But how important is it to listen to the subjective measurements?
Absolutely. We do not want to deny that something like 80% of women report lapses in memory and other cognitive functions postpartum. So our next challenge is to explain why this is, if it's not based on objective measurable differences in cognitive function. And I think our study suggests that capacity is the same, but that doesn't mean that the capacity isn't being overwhelmed by the demands of parenthood. It doesn't mean that the capacity isn't being reallocated to other things, or that a lack of confidence makes people feel as if their cognitive functions have declined.
Does that mean that the term, the concept, the conversation around baby brain is set to continue, isn't it?
I think so. I think it's definitely important to acknowledge these experiences, but I also think that the response to those experiences might change with this kind of research. So with enough sleep and enough support, it's not that postpartum cognitive decline is an inevitable part of the transition to parenthood, but rather we can kind of support women and men as they transition into parenthood to feel more confident in their capabilities and the fact that they're learning a whole host of new things with the arrival of their baby.
I want to put a couple of texts to you, Kelsey, if I may. This from Gil or Jill. I think the mental decline is more brain overload when you have to plan for multiple humans. My brain has never been as sharp since the birth of my four children. So that sort of really backs up what you're saying there. I mean, in terms of that postpartum fog, if you like, that can last for years.
Yeah, it can. I also think it's important to say that from data from our lab, it looks like having children might increase your capabilities over your lifetime. So as you age, there's a neuroprotective effect of children, and that might be due to the complicated things that you're managing in being a parent and all that multitasking that you're doing.
Mm. Juliana asks, did the study look at breastfeeding mothers as the lack of uninterrupted sleep over many months did my head in?
I think definitely breastfeeding affects sleep and doesn't make you feel good about anything.
It really doesn't. Thank you for your research, Kelsey. It's really interesting.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Kelsey Pericard, who's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. We are talking on the Conversation Hour about baby brain. This on text, I couldn't afford to have baby brain with five children born about 2 years apart. And also we're talking about sexual health and whether we talk enough about sex and sexual health as we get older. I'm 70 this year. AIDS was rampant when I was in my 20s or 30s. Always used condoms, no glove, no love. That's in response to some texts about older men not taking that on. And this, where are the experts' comments on men's sexual health and behaviour? Do women have to take responsibility in the elder sexual space as well as everything else? We will keep that conversation going on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. But are you in the situation where you've had that anxiousness, that anxiety, because you're waiting on the results of a scan, a blood test? Sometimes it can feel even worse than the condition that you are treating. Well, imagine if you're suffering from a cancer with a high rate of relapse. Some blood cancers are like that. And you're living from blood test to blood test. That might be you. We're going to meet someone very soon who's going through all that and talk about how vital emotional support is to their treatment, how much more aware we should be of this impacting treatment as well. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's called scanxiety. It's a hidden trauma when you're basically living from scan to scan. We're going to be talking about someone who's going through it and also someone in the Leukemia Foundation who can talk about the awareness of this. Carolyn in Northcote, what did you want to say?
Okay, so my cancer journey started in January 2012, and I was lucky enough to come across Professor Grant MacArthur at the old Peter Mac, and he had recently been to America, and one of the topics that he had learned was, do not take too long to give the results to your patients. And I said, well, what do you class as too long? He said, no longer than 48 hours. Right. Now, that happened. And the lead up to having a scan is terrible.
Mm.
Having the scan is no walk in the park. And waiting for the results is even worse.
Yeah.
Now, happily, everything's gone okay. I've had a few ups and downs. My hematologist now knows what I'm like. And if I have a scan, as I did in mid-January, in the morning, by the afternoon, she's got the results and she sent me the result in an SMS.
Right. So it's about that person knowing you and knowing how you think and how you feel.
Yeah, and you have to have this dialogue with your specialist, and you also have to trust your specialist, and you also have to say what you want.
Mm. Carolyn, so good to hear that you're on the way, that you're recovering.
Oh, no, I'm in remission.
Yeah. Well,
I'm definitely in remission.
Good on you. Good on you, Caroline. That's really interesting insight and advice along the way. M. Meads is someone who has lived experience of blood cancer and also what is called scanxiety, and joins me now. Hi, Em.
Hi, how you going?
I'm very well, thank you. Tell us about your condition and why you have to keep having scans.
So I was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, in November 2023. It's a pretty aggressive form of leukemia, and it doesn't have a lot of really obvious symptoms. It basically mimics a virus or fatigue, one of the kind of symptoms for a relapse, and it has a really high relapse rate. So I think about 80% of people who've had AML will relapse within the first 5 years.
Right.
So I have 6 weekly blood tests to see where my leukemia markers are, and then 6 weekly, like with that, a follow-up with my hematologist every 6 weeks as well. So every 6 weeks I'm sort of have that moment of just like, is it back? Because I've been in remission since pretty much 2 years this week, actually.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Thanks.
But every 6 weeks,
yeah,
when it hits you so fast, you've already got that to deal with. And then this is a six-week proposition.
Yeah, it's kind of an exhausting cycle, if I'm honest.
Mm.
And for both me and it impacts my partner as well. And, you know, if I've been a little bit sick, because my immune system's not been the same since treatment, so if I get a bit sick around scans as well, it just heightens that. And then you spend, you know, a week and a half to 2 weeks waiting for the result to come back. because there's some molecular testing they do online that takes a bit longer.
When was it becoming? Oh, beg your pardon, Em. Sorry, what were you saying?
No, go.
I was just going to ask you, Em. Did it happen, this, what we're terming, I don't know who's called it, this scansiety? Did you feel that from the first one onwards, or is it a matter that it, you know, once you realise that this is going to be what you're facing for a while, does that make it worse?
I think when I first hit remission, I was also having 3-monthly bone marrow biopsies, and I think that they were probably a little bit, like, they really triggered the scansiety quite a lot, going in to have that biopsy every sort of 3 months. It eased a little bit, but over the last couple of weeks, I'm at kind of that 2-year mark, which is sort of that first 2 to 3 years is the really high relapse risk sort of time period. I think at the moment in particular, I'm probably experiencing it a little bit more.
Why is that, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think it's to do with the time periods, and I think it's to do with the, like, there's just this constant thrum under everything always of, like, in a waiting period of it coming back, and you just expect every result it's going to be there. And when it's not, you have a few weeks of relief, and then you go straight back into a blood test to, like, see if it's there again. I just feel like there's not a lot of downtime or enough, like, there's not much time in between, so it just compounds for me anyway.
You're listening to Em Meads, who has AML, and we're talking about that fear, that anxiety that comes from living from blood test or scan to scan on the conversation hour. Em, you described it just then as a constant thrum, but you have to sort of live in between these things. How do you cope with that, that sort of casting your mind forward, trying to cast off any thought, I guess, about, you know, the implications of the next one and then going to that next scan? What are the methods that you've come to use?
First of all, big believer in accessing mental health support when you need them. And so I think making sure you're engaging with professionals, whether it's psychologists, counsellors, your GP, whoever you need to around that. I'm also incredibly lucky. I have the most amazing partner, and she just is such a pillar of support in those moments. My best friend and my friendship group are phenomenal as well. Like, they always check in, and they've always got my back. Distractions helpful. You know, after I've had my blood tests, we always go out for a little treat afterwards.
That's fantastic.
You know, like, you just find the things, and I think talking about it, and I think we don't talk about this stuff enough. And when we don't talk about it, people feel more isolated and alone in it.
Well, I was going to ask you, Em, did anyone ever mention this to you as a phenomenon?
No, not really. And I think that is a gap, is that, like, when people achieve remission, I think we focus so hard on getting people to remission that the aftermath sometimes is overlooked. And I think society is getting better around that, but it's why I'm so passionate about talking about it.
Yeah. Em Meads, I am so happy that you came here to talk about it, and I'm sure everyone who's listening is wrapping their arms around you. And stay well with your friends and your supportive partner, and we really wish you the best. Thank you for helping us understand a bit from your point of view.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Em Meads, who lives with AML. And here from the Leukemia Foundation, the CEO, Chris Tanti, joins me now. Hi, Chris. How typical is Em's story?
Oh, it's really typical and heartbreaking to hear, actually. And, you know, I'm in touch with quite a few patients who talk about this a lot. And some of your questions around, you know, did anyone ever talk to you about this? Did anyone ever tell you it was going to be like this? The answer is no for most people. You know, they go into hospital and they go through a regimen of treatment. And then if that fails, they go through the next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
Because they're dealing with the people who are dealing with the cancers or the conditions, aren't they? They're not talking about beyond the remission.
Yeah, correct. And so everybody in hospital is trying to kill the cancer. you know, that's the aim, and to a greater or lesser extent they managed to do that. And, you know, 5-year survival rates are getting better all the time. So the data's getting better all the time. The issue is that people then have to live their lives in a particular way, and it feels like they can't get on with their lives, that they're not getting on with their lives. And, you know, as Em was saying, you know, you go week to week, test to test, and in lots of ways, you know, when we think about the way we live our lives, we think about the future, and we're planning for the future, and we're doing things to progress. In some respects, the only way to manage this is on a day-to-day basis, and enjoy the moments that you have, and that's try to live in the moment. Yeah, I think that's what seems to work for the majority of people. But people do need significant levels of mental health support to get through it, and they're incredibly courageous. The diagnosis is, you know, the diagnosis upends your life completely. It's an existential crisis, if you like, and then living with it means that you can't, you know, you can't get back on track. You can't get the life that you necessarily want.
You're listening to Chris Tanti, who's CEO of Leukemia Foundation. We're talking about the difficulty of living between scans to scans. Chris, you were talking about living from moment to moment. I guess we, all of us, whether we're well or we have difficulties, we're all trying to do that, but even the Buddhist monks among us will find that hard over a long period of time. What are the resources that anyone listening might turn to for dealing with, I guess, just the sheer exhaustion? You can try and deal with it internally, but how do you deal with it if that's just not working?
Well, I think Em was, you know, I think Em hit the nail on the head when she talked about talking about it. Mm. Now, you know, when we think about cancer treatment, and, you know, I keep having a number of discussions about this with patients and with others in the sector. Most people think about it as acute care, as, you know, in Melbourne, it's going to Peter Mac or the Alfred and getting care and treatment. But actually, the majority of people are spending their time in the community, and there aren't those supports in the community. So it's really about trying to, and the Leukemia Foundation is exploring this in more detail, trying to create communities of interest with the right types of services involved, so people can get, you know, exercise physiology and a whole range of other things that people need post-treatment, but also the opportunity to talk to someone, to participate in the life of, you know, of a facility, for example. We have a group on the Sunshine Coast called Bloom Hill, and mm-hmm. it is an organisation that's called Bloom Hill, and it's a community run cancer support service. And in that facility, there are, you know, 350 different volunteers who participate in gardening and op shops and a whole range in the cafe and a whole range of things. Mm. And there are nurses and allied health that people can sort of engage with. Yeah. But the majority of those volunteers are people who have experienced cancer, or their family members have experienced cancer. They don't necessarily want to talk about it, but they want to be with others who understand where they're at and yeah. understand the fatigue and the distress that kind of goes along with it. And I think that is a really important element of treatment.
Yeah. And Chris, you're saying that the Leukemia Foundation, if we donate to it, it can support people who are affected by scanxiety and all these psychological and mental impacts that blood cancers bring. Is that right? That's yeah, your current appeal?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we rely on the generosity of the community to do what we do. We, you know, have accommodation and psychosocial support services and provide financial assistance because, of course, people aren't working during these periods. Mm. And, you know, it's all desperately needed, and we rely on the community to support us to do that. So, and I understand there are a couple of our philanthropists who are saying if people donate, they'll match the donations. So,
there we go. That's a call out.
Yeah. So, you know, we really encourage people to donate, because there is a huge call on our resources, yep. And we want to be able to provide that support.
Chris, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That's Chris Tanti from the Leukemia Foundation, and you can donate by visiting leukemia.org.au. We've been talking about that. We've also been talking about baby brain because science says it doesn't exist. Jennifer, in officer, what do you say to that?
Well, I can understand that it may not be a physically diagnosed condition, but I can also tell you that anyone who hasn't slept for more than 2 hours at a time for weeks, literally weeks,
yes.
is unable to focus, unable to concentrate, unable to remember where they put the baby.
That tells a story, Jennifer.
I always found him. Please, let me reassure everyone, I always found him. But, I mean, that's a technique that's been used as an instrument of torture in war.
That's true.
Get people to confess.
So what you're saying is, I think as Kelsey did say, look, it's the subjective experience still needs to be validated. And if it's called baby brain, if we want to call it that just to sum it all up and explain what we're going through, well, we're going to stick to that.
I agree.
Jennifer, I'm so glad that you found the baby again. Just one last question. How long do you reckon that lasted in your life?
18 months.
18 months.
Yep.
That's a long time with that torturous experience. Thank you, Jennifer, for calling. And thank you for everyone for leaning into that conversation. This on text as well. They can say what they like about the evidence. I was only 3 weeks off a due date. I walked into work one day. I realised I couldn't remember the kids' names and background information. Just all gone. Had to phone the council director and say I couldn't remember and so could not be legally responsible for the services at that time. Don't tell me that wasn't baby brain. I love that. This on text about scanxiety. I am a breast cancer survivor. I actually stopped going back for testing because of the anxiety. It was taking the joy out of life, waiting for results. Oh, best wishes to you, whoever wrote that text. And this, Kathleen in Melbourne says, during the AIDS epidemic, many of my friends were living in terror between their blood tests. It went on for years and years. Many of them are still living like this. As I said, so many of our listeners will be hearing those stories and hope you understand that we are reaching out our arms around you and hope everything is going well. Thanks so much for joining all of our conversations today about the wild and wonderful ways of the human body. That was Conversation Hour. I'll talk to you next time.